Department of Environmental Quality et al., this is Walensky and Ms. Gooch, and I will once again ask for counsel, who may have just come in the courtroom, if you're here to argue the case, please be sure you sign in either before you argue the case or after you argue the case. And Ms. Walensky, would you like to reserve time for rebuttal now?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, how long?
5 minutes.
5 minutes. Thank you. Whenever you're ready, ma'am.
May it please the court, I'm Tammy Walensky and I represent the appellants in this action. The appellants argue that the statute is plain on its face. There's no ambiguity in statute that may afford the DEQ any weight in its interpretation of the statute. The appellants ask this court to interpret the words of the statute as written.
Well, if we're going to do that, I understand your position that DEQ was sort of picking and choosing what wildlife they're going to study in connection with honoring their statutory mandate here. But it seems to me, in your brief at least, you leave out a very important word, and that's the word relevant. Code 10.1-1197.6b7 says, where relevant, an analysis of the beneficial adverse impact of the proposed project on natural resources. And then it goes on to say, for wildlife, that analysis, referring presumably back to the relevant analysis discussed in the previous sentence, shall be based on information on the presence, activity, and migratory behavior of wildlife to be collected at the site, etc. So why, whether it's ambiguous or not, why doesn't the plain language of the statute give DEQ the discretion, if you will, to use their expertise to decide what relevant wildlife is going to be impacted by this energy project?
My reading of the statute is that relevant modifies the terms beneficial and adverse impact. So if after wildlife data is collected, it's determined that there is impact, if there's beneficial impact that's relevant, that gets analyzed. If there's adverse impact that's relevant, that gets analyzed. So the word relevant is in a different sentence from the word wildlife. And
Except for the fact you're correct, but the sentence, the word after wildlife is, the phrase is that analysis. And it seems to me that references back, or at least in context, would seem to me to reference back to the preceding sentence, which talks about a relevant analysis.
A relevant analysis.
I mean, I guess we're arguing about how many angels can dance on the head of a pin here, but it seems to me that whether it's whether the term wildlife is ambiguous or not, I understand the circuit court ruled that because it was ambiguous, the department had the discretion to utilize its expertise, if you will, to determine what to study. But it seems to me, even if it's unambiguous, the statute itself gives them that discretion. How do you respond to that?
Well, the statute doesn't give the agency discretion to predetermine the relevance of impacts to wildlife before the data is collected. And the statute specifically calls for the analysis to be based on the presence, activity, and migratory behavior of wildlife collected at the site for a period of time dictated by the site conditions and biology of the wildlife being studied, not to exceed 12 months. And so the appellant's argument is that the relevance of beneficial and adverse impacts cannot be determined until that data is collected. And what the DEQ did, and they did it because they wanted to save the developers money, they predetermined which wildlife would or would not get studied. There is no site-specific contemporaneous data collection.
It seems to me that, there's a basic tenet of administrative law that various executive agencies have certain expertise in certain areas that they bring to bear on the regulatory process. In this case, it's the protection of the environment. And the question seems to me devolves down to what did the General Assembly do, either tell the agency you have no discretion at all as to how to go about this process, or you have some. We're talking about wind turbines, these 100-foot tall towers with giant blades on them that spin at a given rate and generate electricity. And plain logic would suggest, okay, it probably makes sense to study the impact of those things on birds, for example, especially migratory birds. But what sense does it make to determine what the effect of a wind turbine that's 100 feet up in the air would have on, for example, a snail or a raccoon or a bear, if you will, that's wandering around on the ground? So I understand your position to be, if it's alive, if it's organic, you know, part of the animal kingdom, if you will, it's got to be studied by, because that's what the statute says, which would seem to me to, at least in context, be counterintuitive if you don't permit the agency to bring some discretion to bear about, you know, what is really likely to have, it uses resources to determine what's really likely to have impact versus what isn't. Clearly, they may make a mistake and maybe not cover everything that in retrospect they should, but it seems to me that's the purpose of the statute requiring a study so that they can tweak it later. I mean, is that a nonsensical approach to the interpretation here?
Well, the agency has predetermined what gets studied, and it stopped that information basis in 2010. The turbines that are proposed right now are 550 feet tall. They're larger.
What are you potentially studying here that's going to be impacted by these turbines that isn't being studied?
The information that has come out since this regulation was promulgated and actually was being evidenced at that time is that turbines generate infrasound, which is low-frequency noise that is actually a weapon of mass destruction. It's used to harm and harass people in interrogation purposes, for example. So infrasound affects human beings. It's an issue that is being litigated all over the United States, in Europe, in Canada right now. It affects human beings. There is an absence of information about the effects of that infrasound on wildlife. And so while, yes, the spinning blades are known to kill bats, and at the time were actually known to kill birds as well, there are other impacts from the operation of the turbines that this regulation excludes from consideration because it stops the information base in time in the year 2010 and says we will only be concerned about impacts to bats and certain other species. And even though the department says that they may consider other significant impacts, if you never require the data to be collected, then there is no underlying basis by which to consider other significant impacts. Furthermore, if an industry, if the DEQ decides after the fact to find a significant impact, I think that any imposition of that would be challenged by a developer. Here's the thing, is that public policy considerations in this instance are that this regulation is actually very arbitrary. What if the paper exercise, the database exercise that's required to look in a database for the presence of wildlife? What if it shows that there, at some point in the past, there was a species of wildlife present? Well, the developer could argue, but it's not there anymore. Well, then you're in this position of trying to prove a negative. The DEQ would be compelled, because of the database, to say that the species is present, and we're going to require mitigation. And the industry would be saying, but it's not there anymore. But the database says it's there. So this regulation cuts both ways in its arbitrary application. It's, so for public policy considerations, this court should find it not in compliance with the law. The DEQ...
Yes. You're about to go into your rebuttal time. If you'd like to use that now, you're welcome to, or work after the opposing counsel. You can save your 5 minutes.
Please. Yes, I need to save my 5 minutes because the crosswalk.
Good morning. May it please the court. Matt Gooch here for the Department of Environmental Quality. I'd like to start on a different subject, which is the cross error. The circuit court below didn't have jurisdiction over this appeal in the first place because Carr and the petitioners, all collectively refer to them as Carr, filed their notice of appeal late. So I'll start with a couple of points
that deals with the final adoption is that the term existed back before the amendment. The statute was amended in 2011.
14.
But we had the Russell case out there that in dicta wasn't necessarily deciding the issue. It seems to me spelled out what the term final adoption meant. It's certainly confusing. I think it's since been resolved now by the amendment, but at the time it was pretty confusing. And that's the law, of course, we have to apply to this situation.
Agreed. Russell is the law that will apply. Also,
but you don't think Russell is correct, at least the dicta of Russell.
Well, I think the dicta didn't really consider the arguments that I presented on brief and I'll present to you today. The key piece of the puzzle that was the court didn't address, and in fairness, I don't think it was presented to the court in the first place, is the language of 4012B, which says, all regulations may be formally and finally adopted by the signed order of the agency so stating. So you have an express statement in the APA in 2010 telling us.
What you're saying essentially is if the agency director then signs it, then that's when the date starts ticking.
Correct.
So if that director decides to stick it in his account, what notice does the person have to actually appeal it using your logic?
Well, the same...
becomes effective.
Sorry, I didn't interrupt you.
No, you're fine.
The same is true under Rule 1-1 for circuit court orders. This is not a foreign concept. The date that an order is effective, a final order for appeal to this court, is the date the judge writes next to his signature, the date of entry. It's not the date that it's posted to the website or the date that counsel receives it in the mail.
But those orders are actually within the public domain. Whereas with publication, obviously that would give notice to people who wish to appeal that the order is effective as opposed to when it's being signed. Would you agree with that premise in terms of the notification time?
Absolutely, Judge Mello. I won't stand before you today and say that the old system was a better system or that it hasn't been improved upon significantly. I think if you asked a public policy think tank, what's the best way to do an administrative notification procedure?
Well, I also pointed out the term final adoption or finally adopted, variations on the phrase, is used throughout the APA, and it means different things in different contexts. There's no and the General Assembly didn't until the amendment didn't trouble to really define that, and that's what Russell, the dicta Russell struggled with. Now, the issue didn't have to be decided in Russell, which is why the analysis is pure dicta. But we do have to decide it today. You made that eminently clear. So, given that at the time we have the agency finally adopting it when it signed, as you pointed out. We have a reference to adoption when it's published in the register, and we have the fact that the governor can still make amendments to it for a period of time. And therefore, what the regulation may ultimately look like when everybody is done with it may be very different from what it looked like when you assert that it was, quote, finally adopted.
I won't take issue with one part of your premise there, and that's that if the governor does require an amendment, it would be a separate and different adoption. There's only one final adoption.
It's final. Final adoption isn't final.
Well, the same is true under Rule 1:1. You enter it on a day, and then it's not 21 days pass. The court doesn't stamp it or give it some extra final adoption. There's just a waiting period. The same is true in the APA. We have a 30-day waiting period in the APA where either the governor or the legislature can raise a concern, sort of like you might think of a motion for reconsideration. And you know the agency would reopen it at that time. It starts a clock ticking, just as the same is true in Rule 1:1. 21 days pass, and then it's over. So, again, this is not a foreign, alien concept. I don't know that we really raised it in Russell.
One way to General Assembly's action in the amendment is, you know, they're presumed to actually read our case, which I think is one of those legal fictions sometimes. I don't think anybody actually reads our case. But in any event, they responded to the dicta of Russell by straightening out the problem and fixing the date and basically telling us what we meant the law all along to be is what we're telling you it is now with this amendment. And if that's the case, that would seem to undercut your argument.
No, I mean, there's a statute, a principle of statutory interpretation, which is that the General Assembly can put in there, they can indicate this is restating existing law. And they didn't do that. It's pretty clearly changing. In fact, in Russell, the date that they selected was the date of publication, and that's not one of the 2 dates that this court used or considered in Russell. It was a third date. It's the one that the federal government uses for theirs. And it's, for public policy reasons, it's a sensible date to, for the General Assembly to choose.
I hope that's not your only argument, though. But, I mean, in other words, you want to address the merits of...
No, it's not my only argument at all, but I think that it's we have serious arguments here. And the court should never even get to the merits if it simply applies the adoption as it's used in the APA, which is entry of the order. The public policy considerations aren't the law. The question before the court is, what was the law in 2010? And it's clearly an agency adopts a regulation when it signs it. So I will now turn to the merits. So Your Honor raised... The wildlife protections could, as Ms. Belinsky has pointed out, she would like to see different wildlife protected. There might be other parties in this courtroom or out there, wind developers, who might like to see different wildlife protected. There's a line-drawing exercise that has to happen. So the statute's not ambiguous because it gives DEQ a clear grant of authority to pick that wildlife. But it...
So, the circuit court was wrong in finding the term wildlife to be ambiguous?
Well, I think it said that the wildlife provisions are ambiguous. And I don't, I caution the court not to get caught up in looking at this the wrong way. If I were to say, you know, give someone $20 and say, go get some takeout to eat, bring it back, that's not a, it's not ambiguous, but I'm not sure if they're going to come back with Chinese food or pizza. It could be a few different results. Here the General Assembly has given DEQ the authority and it's expressed its traditional rulemaking function to come up with wildlife protection provisions for study and protection. DEQ chose what wildlife to protect. That doesn't make the statute ambiguous necessarily. We think it's a pretty clear grant of authority. As Your Honor, as question indicated, it's a pretty clear grant of authority to DEQ to determine what wildlife needs protection. Now, it can seem ambiguous when you say, well, we didn't protect bears. General Assembly didn't say bears. Are bears included? That's really left for the expert agency to determine. So I think the court's rationale, it used the word ambiguous, but I think its underlying rationale was correct, which is that the statute gives authority to DEQ to make the judgment call about what species to protect.
Well, I won't make her argument before, but I suspect your opponent would suggest that at the time this project was approved, at the time the statute was enacted, the whole point was, the point of this particular provision of the statute, is if we're going to build some wind farms as alternative energy sources in Virginia, let's study what the impact of these things is going to be on the environment. And because they're a relatively new wrinkle. At least they were back at the time the statute was enacted. And perhaps they'll have some negative impact or some adverse impact that needs to be considered if we're going to allow these projects to be expanded or to be built, you know, on a larger scale. And so why isn't that a reasonable interpretation of it? And so if you're going to, you know, predetermine what's going to be impacted when you don't know because we haven't done this before, isn't that the cart before the horse? How would you respond to that?
It's the department's call. The department ultimately gets to make the judgment call about how they're going to do these regulations and what they're going to protect. At the end of our argument, Ms. Volinsky even said that, you know, for public policy considerations, the court ought to read the statute a certain way. DEQ has been given the power by the General Assembly to make these judgment calls, to do the line drawing exercises, and it chose, based on the best information, the science that it had at the time, to protect the species that it did and study the species that it did, and the way that the regulation was promulgated. It's just a basic philosophical difference between our two sides. Ms. Belinsky and the CAR petitioners see this as a micromanaged effort by the General Assembly to direct exactly what's going on, and that's not what happened. They said, we're relevant. They handed the authority to DEQ.
Well, if that was what was going on, they certainly got that right, don't they? The General Assembly can micromanage whatever they want to.
Absolutely.
They want to drill down to that level.
I agree 100%. I think the General Assembly could come back and say, DEQ, we saw what you did. We'd like you to, in addition, do this or that in the regulation. No dispute with any of that. But they didn't micromanage in the PBR statute. They just handed us some authority that we went with and created a regulation that not everyone was happy with, which is often the case with regulations. You're not going to get every single person to buy in or agree with it. But again, it's just a basic philosophical difference. We have the power to make those decisions. So, again, I think your Honor's question to lead off gets to the heart of it. You've got express language in the statute here saying that it's where relevant, and therefore DEQ can determine what the relevant analysis is for wildlife, and that's what they did. And that should really be the beginning and the end of it for B7. I think I've got the ambiguity thing. Just give me a moment, let me look at my notes. Ultimately, this is ultimately a policy call for DEQ. They did that. DEQ's, if you want to look at their town hall document they filed, it's page 9, the joint appendix. They explained why they were doing what they were doing. They weren't going to regulate new species. And it's worth noting that there are existing protections out there for all of the species that one might be concerned about, or there's the power to regulate. So, for instance, you've got DGIF, who has the authority to promulgate regulations for a conditional take permit. You have the Fish and Wildlife Service that still requires a conditional take permit for take of federally protected, threatened, and endangered species. DEQ made the policy call unless there's a good reason to regulate another species, they weren't going to do it. And based on the science they had, they chose to regulate bats because it was proven to them that you can mitigate for bats. Sort of make an illustration, the bats target the wind turbines. They're attracted to the electricity that the turbines generate. And so you can mitigate for that by certain low wind speeds or times of year, times of night, could turn the wind turbine off and the bats won't be attracted to it and fly into it. For other species, that isn't true. Raptors, other birds just fly and they fly into wind turbines the same way they would fly into a tall building. Which, not in the administrative record, I don't think, but a fun fact is the number one killer of birds in this country is buildings, not wind turbines, and then cats, and then wind turbines. So, in other words, if we were going to start getting into the study and mitigation of wildlife that can't be mitigated against, it would be a futile exercise, and that's not what the General Assembly was giving us the power to do here. They were charging us with creating wind turbine regulations. And that's what we did. We weren't going to require futile mitigation, futile study. But to close, I'll just say that this is a basic philosophical difference. We have the power to do what we did. It might not be popular with the people that might live close to some of these projects, but it was certainly within our statutory grant of authority. There are no other questions. I will. All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
In regard to the crosshair, first, the argument by the agency that the General Assembly could have stated that it was affirming pre-existing law is nonsensical, because the problem with the rules is that, in the statute, is that it's it was flexible, and so the General Assembly didn't know what the pre-existing law was, and it was frankly being used whichever way worked for the state at the time. And that was one of the problems that the trial court had with the statute. The second basis for finding that the notice was timely is that, and based on Judge Malvo's comments, in this case, unlike the Russell case, the agency delayed publication. There was a long gap between when the agency signed its memo and when it publicized. But in this case, the agency went right to publication. And in doing so, it would have made, under the agency's analysis, the petition for appeal due before the regulation was finally adopted. It would have made the petition premature. It would have made no one at the effect of the regulation, no one would have had standing to appeal at that time because the regulation wasn't final. And that's the basis upon which Judge Marco reversed the Sherwin-Williams case in this case. The judge recognized that the inconsistency and flexibility would have resulted in that outcome, and so therefore the notice in this case was timely. The state is using the word protected wildlife. We're not talking about protecting wildlife here. We're talking about collecting data, using that data to analyze impacts, and then determine significance. We're talking about what the statute prescribes. Protection comes later with the mitigation requirements, but you can't get to the mitigation requirements until you collect the data and you know what wildlife is there, what it's the presence, activity, migratory behavior, collected based on the site conditions for a period of time not to exceed 12 months. That's all site-specific language in a temporal context, project-specific, site-specific,
well,
temporal.
Let me interrupt you. When I read your brief, frankly, I was a little confused because you used very broad language in your brief. The statute, of course, is designed to cover projects like this anywhere in the Commonwealth. This one happens to be in the mountains in Western Virginia. They're talking about doing a similar project as a test basis in my part of Virginia, which is Virginia Beach, offshore. Those things may well have an impact on whales. I suspect there are not a lot of whales in Roanoke County. I'm going to go out on a limb here and suggest that. So in DEQ, you're not seriously suggesting, as I thought you did on your brief, that the failure of DEQ to determine the impact of a wind turbine in Highland or Bath or Roanoke County on a whale is important data to collect.
It might be important data to collect offshore, but they haven't even asked for that. They're not requiring it, because they've excluded the impacts of whales, which would be affected by infrasound. There are a whole bunch of whales beached in the Bering Strait? I don't know my European geography. And they think it was due to the wind turbines.
Well,
It's on the internet. So,
oh, well, we're
okay, right.
Our precedent.
Exactly. I know, but what I'm saying is that they've excluded many species of wildlife, and it's not that they need to be protected. It's that the data needs to be collected. It needs to be analyzed. It needs to be determined whether there's adverse or beneficial impact. It could be a beneficial impact, and the other issue here is the using the rat. The agency wants to base...
Your time is up, but I'll give you a minute to wind it up if you like.
The regulatory advisory panel. The agency relies on the regulatory advisory panel to justify the way it interprets the regulation. That's what they do. The public participation guidelines say that the RAP can be used for technical guidance only, but they clearly wade it into statutory interpretation. And so if you're going to give the agency leeway to interpret, the weight of their decision should not include anything that the RAP was involved in, because you can't separate the technical guidance from statutory interpretation. So if you're going to get to the weight of the agency's interpretation, the RAP should be excluded from that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We will recap and then we'll take action.